Gracias por descargar este podcast de Hey Festival. Para más información sobre nuestros festivales internacionales y sobre cómo acceder a nuestro archivo, por favor visite heyfestival.org. Gracias.
Terrific. Good morning.
Good morning, Colombia.
My name is Jonathan Levi, and I just wanted to tell you a little bit about something 30 years ago. A memory, how I still remember in 1985, sitting in a small movie theater on West 73rd Street in Manhattan, a movie theater that was torn down a long time ago, and feeling really, really uncomfortable watching Daniel Day-Lewis kiss Gordon Warnicke in My Beautiful Laundrette. It might be hard to imagine now, 30 years later, how someone could be uncomfortable seeing two men kiss on screen, but as the name of Hanif Qureshi started entering into my own consciousness, it came as sort of the champion of the uncomfortable. And he was also a champion of the gay movement, which was increasingly getting traction in the United States and in the world in the wake of the tragedy of AIDS in the 1980s. And a couple of years later, when we published Hanif's short story, With My Tongue Down Your Throat, and I pulled out an old copy of Granta magazine, I was the US editor of it at the time, a terrific story, I met Hanif in New York and was doubly surprised because, number one, he was actually a really, really nice guy. And number two, he had a girlfriend. And, you know, I began to appreciate at that point, really, that Hanif had powers of creation and imagination. And now, 30 years later, and several movies later, most recently Le Weekend with Jim Broadbent and Lindsay Duncan, and not to mention several novels later, from The Buddha of Suburbia to his current novel, out in English, The Last Word, Hanif is still making people uncomfortable, but in the most imaginative way possible. So I'm suggesting to you this morning, ladies and gentlemen, sit back, get comfortable, and don't say I didn't warn you. Hanif Qureshi.
Thank you, Jonathan. Thank you very much. I would just like to say that as I was leaving to come to this event, I saw my dear friend Stephen Frears, who directed My Beautiful Laundrette, staggering towards the hotel. So I think he may be sitting somewhere in this audience, sleeping cheerfully, I would imagine. And Stephen Frears was the man who negotiated the kiss between Daniel Day-Lewis and Gordon Warnicke in My Beautiful Laundrette. And I have to say, neither of us have, nor indeed Daniel Day-Lewis, have looked back since.
But did you know at the time that it would make people uncomfortable?
I wrote My Beautiful Laundrette. I was at that time staying in my family's house in Pakistan, and I had jet lag, I couldn't sleep, so I stayed up writing this movie, and Channel 4, the television, had just started, and they were commissioning new writers. Mm-hmm. And in those days, I got all the so-called ethnic work, because in those days I was the only ethnic writer that anybody knew. And they asked me to write a movie, and I was writing My Beautiful Laundrette, and I wrote the whole movie a few times, and it was about two friends running a laundrette together. And I'd been involved, tangentially, in the laundrette business myself through my family. And the movie, it didn't quite work. And then I thought that these two boys should kiss. And when they kissed, I felt a little bit, as you put it, uncomfortable. But I also felt a bit shocked by it. I thought, why would a gay skinhead kiss a Pakistani boy in a laundrette? And then it seemed to me that shock would convey itself to the audience, I guess. And I thought, that's my job, which is to, as it were, shock myself a little bit now and again and pass those shocks on to you in exchange for money. And I guess that's probably what writers do. Something occurs to us, and if we're lucky, years later, it will also occur to the reader or the audience.
Yeah, for a shockingly large amount of money as well.
Yes, yeah.
I mean, you got an Oscar nomination out of your screenplay for My Beautiful Laundrette.
Well, that film was made very cheaply and very quickly, and it was made very naively. Actually, I don't think we could have gone to Los Angeles and pitched a film saying, listen, studio execs, we've got a great idea of a movie about a gay Pakistani and a gay skinhead running a laundrette together. I don't think that would necessarily have got a studio interested. So you make them very cheaply, and you make them quickly, you make them under the radar, as it were, and you just about get away with it. It seems to me that's the way to do it.
Which of those different combinations do you think was the lead one that got your audience interested? Because it was a big audience that got interested in Laundrette. Was it the skinhead? Was it the Pakistani? Was it portraying a Pakistani in a major film? Was it the relationship between the two of them?
I think it was all those things. It was a modern film, and I think at that time, it was the early Thatcher period, and it was also a period because a Thatcher of nostalgia, and it was the time of David Lean's movie Passage, or Back Passage to India, as we used to call it, Room with a View, and the other Jim Ivory films, and there was a lot of stuff on TV about the colonial period, and I think we, Stephen, and the rest of us were really sick of that view of Britain. That was a new Britain emerging, and Britain was looking to the past. So we thought, let's do something really modern. Let's do something about what it's like to live in London today. And in those days, I was friends with the movie director, Derek Jarman. And he had a flat on the Charing Cross Road, and he said he would sit in his flat overlooking the cinema house opposite on the Charing Cross Road and see all these beautiful gay boys queuing up to go and see this movie about a gay skinhead set in London, you know. And in those days, we were capable of being just ahead, you might say, just ahead of our era, and have managed through some chemical explosion to somehow capture that time.
Mm-hmm. How did your family react when Laundrette came out? Were they surprised that this was the movie that you had been writing in Pakistan over the past year?
Well, funnily enough, when the movie opened in New York, there were demonstrations against the movie, which I used to go to up on 72nd, mm-hmm. on 72nd Street.
Yeah.
And I've still got photographs, and the whole of the Pakistani community of Manhattan used to go and walk around the cinema.
I think that was the cinema where I saw it, yeah.
Yeah. It was interesting. Obviously, this was long before the fatwa against Rushdie, and they used to march up and down with their placards, and then they threatened to bomb the cinema and close it down and the usual stuff. And I used to go and talk to them and say, what's going on? And they would say, there is not one single homosexual in Pakistan. You're misrepresenting our community. I have to say, I've done my best to misrepresent this community for the rest of my life. And it seems to me that misrepresenting communities is what writers are born, I think, to do.
But they
weren't too pleased. My family were not too pleased. My aunts were furious. Everybody was furious. It seems to me that that's a very good sign for a writer, actually. I'm a creative writing student, and some of my students come and see me, and I say, well, tell me a story, and they tell me a really good story, and I say, oh, that's great. We'll go and write that down, and they say, I can't write that down. My mother would be horrified. And you think, well, you have to say to them, you know, if your mother's not horrified by what you're writing, you're clearly not doing it right.
Your family has been fairly vocal in terms of its horror over the years, complaining that you portrayed your uncle poorly, in a bad light, in Beautiful Laundrette. with, in fact, a great, you know, a great actor, Roshan Seth, playing your Uncle Omar. Your sister has complained about her portrayal in one of your novels.
That wasn't her, actually. That was someone else. It's very amusing how people always misrepresent themselves in movies and in stories. They can't see that it was them or was not them, actually.
But, you know, I wonder if this is a particularly British thing, though, because I know there was a court case in the United States a few years ago of an ex-wife who complained that her husband didn't put her in a novel. But is this something that is peculiarly directed towards you by your family, or do you see this happening in England a lot?
Well, you have to free yourself from those kinds of worries as a writer. And I think you'll find with most artists that they have what Graham Greene described as that chip of ice in their heart. Most artists would have that, you know. Somebody tells you a story and you think, oh, that's a really juicy story. That's a great story. I must write that down. And then you think, well, that story's about someone I know. And then you think, well, should I write that story? But of course, if you're an artist, if you're a writer, you'll write that story and you take the consequences. It's too bad if it's a friend of yours without their trousers on. Why would you worry about that?
Yeah. Well, and also if they tell you... if they complain, they give you more material. I mean, I noticed going back to the Granta that you wrote about the making of your film, Sammy and Rosie Get Laid, and that your girlfriend at the time, Sally, who I think I actually met when I first met you in New York, had complained, in fact, to you. She said the movie should be called Hanif Gets Paid, Sally Gets Exploited. Well, which made great press, but then you picked up on the press and you wrote about that yourself, that whole story.
And then, and then I got a new girlfriend.
And then... So be careful, anybody out there who's going out with writers. You know, it's going to get written about.
If you don't want to be in a book, just keep away from writers. It seems to me to be a very sensible and very straightforward thing to do.
Now, your new novel, The Last Word, is the story of a young biographer, a young white... good-looking, public school type who goes off to write a biography of an aging literary lion from the subcontinent who lives in England and has become more English than the English. And what I'm wondering, and at one point the writer, the Indian writer, says to the English author who's digging up all kinds of dirt on him, don't confuse the author with his characters. Is that something you think about as you're writing your novels?
The truth is, you can't just take somebody and put them in a book. It's a ridiculous idea. People think, you know, something happens to you and you go home and write it down. It's a completely idiotic view of what we do. You know, you write novels, Jonathan. It's, you know, you sit there until your ears bleed. You make stuff up. It's artificial. You move it around. You push it together. You create it, and you imagine around it. So you may or may not start from a familiar point, or from someone you knew, or it may be your mum or your dad or whatever. But in the end, it's a made up story, and in the end, the whole point of the story is really to serve the audience. You know, you're not intending to write a portrait of your next door neighbor, but to make an entertainment for the public. You know, what we're in, as my pal Stephen says, we're in showbiz. It's, you know, we're there to serve the public.
Mm-hmm. But when you're writing a character, do you ever get to a point at which, you know, let's say it's in a movie where you're working with Stephen Frears or you're working with Roger Michel, and they say, what if this character were to do such and such? Do you get a point at which there's a disjunction between the inspiration for that character and what you feel that character needs to do dramatically at that point?
Well, what you do is you take a dramatic situation, a novel, a story, really, is you take someone and then you squeeze them. You know, you make their life awful. You put them in a dramatic situation. You see that with any great storyteller, say P.G. Woodhouse or George Simenon, whose Maigret novels I worship. As soon as that happens, you start to squeeze them, you create conflict and drama. You begin to see, as it were, their insides, their moral ability. And once that happens also, then they stop being, as it were, your neighbor next door, and they become a character in a novel. The truth is, as I say, the reader doesn't care whether where the novel comes from, what the source of the material is, that you are creating an entertainment. And I like to think of myself as a comic writer. You know, My Beautiful Laundrette is a comic film, and The Butcher of Suburbia is a comic novel. But they're comic in terms of being about very serious material. I grew up in London after the war. My father came from India and married my mother, an English woman. I went to school in the 60s, and I became aware during that time that the Britain was changing from a white imperial monocultural former empire to becoming the multicultural mess that it is now. I was aware that there were no books about people like me, and that nobody was writing about race or racism or immigration or the fate of the former empire. And I wanted to read books about people like me. All the writers that were writing about the empire, Forster, Waugh, to a certain extent, Graham Greene, and so on, were white upper class men. And I thought, what about another view? So I began, really, when I was 15 or 16 years old, to write what became The Butcher of Suburbia and bits of My Beautiful Laundrette, I guess, because I grew up with a lot of kids who became skinheads. They weren't as classy as Daniel Day-Lewis was or is. His father, of course, was the poet laureate. But I grew up with a lot of that rough stuff, and so I began to see that those stories hadn't been told. And I guess that's when you realize that you're a writer, when you see something needs to be said. These stories need to be out there in the world. And luckily and unluckily, in another sense, I was in the position to start to tell those stories.
Yeah. I mean, Buddha of Suburbia, for those of you who haven't read it, I think is one of the great chronicles of that time, having been in London around that time. I think Hanif is pitch perfect as far as capturing a lot of that, the tension, the excitement, the creativity. And one of the characters that you write in there, Charlie Hero, who is the stepbrother of the hero of the book, is a white skinhead who becomes somewhat of an early punk star. And you said, I think, at one point that you based... or some of the inspiration for Charlie Hero was Billy Idol, but reading Buddha of Suburbia again now, especially in the wake of the recent death of David Bowie, brings Bowie also to mind. And you knew him, right? And he also worked on Buddha of Suburbia?
Well, Bowie had been to the same school that I'd been to. Obviously, he's more than 10 years older than me. But he'd been to the same school, and he'd lived in Bromley and hung around in the pubs and so on, and we worshipped him. So the character of Charlie Hero in The Buddha of Suburbia was really based on those of us, and partly on Billy Idol, whose real name is, who I knew, and the first person to introduce me to LSD, we sort of based our look on Bowie's Ziggy period. So you'd see, you know, in this really dull suburban place just outside London, you'd see these boys walking around with sort of tin foil and boys with makeup and these dresses. But of course, it's very hard to run in a dress. And you were often threatened by skinheads and rockers and boys in leather jackets. So it was a nerve-wracking experience walking down Bromley High Street in your high heels and dress with a glitter around your eyes. So although the suburbs are a dull and stupid place, they're also interesting too in their creativity, actually, because we were about 10 miles from London. And there was a bridge across the Thames that led to London, which was the, you know, the bridge of sighs, the bridge to freedom.
Do you miss those days?
Well, I spent all my childhood, like all of us in the suburbs then, just trying to get out, mm-hmm. you know? And when there was a, you know, now I'm 60, I think it seems amazing to me that I ever became a writer at all. You know, an Asian kid, delinquent, no education, came from the suburbs and became a writer and indeed made his whole, a living his whole life. As a writer, it seemed to me now an amazing and mad idea to think when you were 16 years old that you could ever do that. Well, you know how tough it is to make a living as a writer. You know, I thought, well, lots of my friends became photographers. They worked for Vivienne Westwood, went into fashion, and they joined bands and all that Bromley stuff that came out of the Sex Pistols. A lot of it came from the suburbs. But they were in rock and roll and they made a lot of money. But becoming a writer seems to me to be a very difficult thing to do. And I'm amazed that it happened. So I'm glad I got out. And it was lucky for me, I think, that I was able to write about race and immigration at a time when it was an interesting subject and nobody else was writing about it.
Well, it's still an interesting subject now. I mean, London is now full of prêt-à-mangers that are staffed by, you know, Italians and Spaniards and Tunisians and people from all over the world. In other words, the notion of finding someone who was not born in England working and living in London is now no longer a rarity. Has London become sort of a homogeneous, multicultural Disneyland, or is there still something edgy and exciting about it?
Well, I grew up in the suburbs, and then I moved to West London, right? West London was really the King's Road, Chelsea. Yeah. Chelsea is now, you would never go there, it's impossible, it's just full of bankers. I live now, so the bit of London that I live now has really become the suburbs again, actually. London has moved, I live in West London, and London has moved east. And I would never go to the east because it's full of people with those beards. I don't know if you have them in Colombia yet. It must be a good reason to live in South America would be the fact you don't have hipsters. We have hipsters in London. Do you have hipsters in Colombia? It's a mercy that it's a hipster. There's one over there. I see there's a man at the back hiding behind his chair. Yes.
Well, actually, there's a famous film critic here in the front row, Samuel Castro from Medellin, who's been trying to grow a hipster beard, I know,
I live in West London, and my house is quite tall, and now I have a pair of binoculars, and which I bought for bird watching. But we have not many birds in the neighborhood, so now I watch the neighbors. And when this is where I do my research. So if you walk past my house, you will see an old Indian man at the window watching you through binoculars. And I can see on my street, basically my street is made up of bankers, mostly immigrants, French bankers, who I refer to as the immigrants.
So it's the post-racial dream then.
I was in Paris the other day, and I was on television, and the interviewer. The first question the interviewer said to me, she said, "You live in London." She said, "Don't you think there are too many immigrants in London?" I said, I couldn't agree with you more. I said, there are far too many immigrants in London, and they're all French, and they're all living in my street. And on the other side of the street are Somalian refugees. So it's basically rich people and poor people now in London. There are no middle class people in London. It's very difficult to be an ordinary middle class person in London and live there. So I think the dream of London is probably over in that sense.
Mm-hmm. Now, thinking of Paris and immigrant terror, when was it? 20 years ago, you wrote The Black Album, a novel.
87, 97. More than 20. Yeah.
Yeah. A long time ago, but before before a lot of our recent memory, you wrote The Black Album about the rise of Islamic fanaticism within a young sort of student class in London. Did you have any idea that things would escalate to the stage that they are now?
I woke up in the night last night because I have jet lag, and I had this memory. When I was a kid, I didn't like to go to school. Education didn't really agree with me. So I used to go. My father worked in the Pakistan embassy, and I used to go to work with my father, and he used to sit in his room, and I used to sit across the room typing. In his office. During Ramadan, as I'm sure you know, during Ramadan you're not allowed to eat and drink during the day. And so my father, he used to take in his briefcase, he used to take sandwiches to work in his briefcase. And during the lunch hour, when everybody else in the Pakistan embassy, obviously a Muslim embassy, everybody went else off to pray, me and my dad would go to the park. And then my dad would sit in the park, he would open his briefcase and he would eat his sandwiches. We would sit there eating our sandwiches. And then my dad would open a beer and he would drink a beer and so on. And I remember my dad was very nervous. He had to hide behind a tree because if any of the other Muslims from the embassy saw him eating his sandwiches and drinking his beer, they would go completely crazy. And he said he would be sacked from his job. So as a child, I learned to be afraid of Muslims. And I could see, I could see the beginnings of terror in that incident. And of course, my family lived in Pakistan, and my uncles used to come from Karachi in the summer when it got hot. And I used to meet them in the hotel. We'd go to a pub, and they would sit down, and they would eat pork pies and drink beer and so on. And they'd say, "For God's sake, don't tell anybody what we're doing." So we were living in an intimidating atmosphere, even then. So I became aware, I think, in Pakistan in the early 80s. Of this new movement called Islamization, because my family had become Reaganites. And I said to them, "For God's sake, you're intellectuals. Why have you become Reaganites?" They said that they saw American freedom as a barrier against Islamization. And my family had been friends with, my father had been at school with Bhutto, who became Prime Minister of Pakistan and was later hanged by Zia-ul-Huq. And so we were aware then, as a family, of the force, the emerging force of Islam as a post-colonial, let's say, liberation force. And then, of course, after the fatwa against my pal Rushdie, I think all of us really became aware of what this version of Islam was about. And so in 89, after the fatwa, I started to do research in the schools and colleges very near to my house. I would just go to these meetings, and I would go to the mosque and see these preachers. And these preachers were just incredible. It was the most incredible theater that I'd ever seen. You'd see these guys, they were like Fidel Castro. I mean, they would talk for 6 or 7 hours. They would march up and down, pronouncing on lipstick, you know, Israel, facelifts, homosexuality, ranting and raving. And I would sit there, you know, writing this stuff down. And I wrote it down, I took it home, and I put it in a book. And that was the truth. Until I finally got thrown out of the mosque, lifted up, literally lifted up and thrown out of the mosque by the security guards there for being a friend of Salman Rushdie. To being a friend of someone, Rushdie can get you into all sorts of trouble in East London. But I could see that this was a very dangerous force, and that these guys were really serious about what they believed. And something, it's interesting, we don't have much seriousness. And neoliberalism, people are not serious about neoliberalism in the same sort of way. It's a different kind of ideology. So I could see that radical Islam was the only actually political force in the world that actually stands, you might say, outside capitalism, to which there is now no other ideological opposition.
No, and you paint that very well in the Black Album as well, that your satire is not limited to the fundamentalists, but also to people of a variety of stripes, including on the liberal left in England. But what was going on then? I mean, Salman is now living quite happily in New York and presumably quite safely. But over in Europe, with the Charlie Hebdo and then the Paris massacre and other massacres around the world, in Beirut and in Sharm el-Sheikh, perhaps, and many other places, we're talking about a new escalation. Did you see that coming? Did you think that this was something that was possible beyond, you know, sacking your father for eating during Ramadan? This is something qualitatively different, do you think?
Well, this is a hideous and very, very dangerous ideology that is obviously very serious and will become more and more serious, and it's a real threat to liberalism, and it's extremely dangerous, and we really have to think really hard about how to combat that, and it's a form of religious Nazism, actually, and I think that should give us hope that it's a form of Nazism. By which I mean that it's possible to make an ideology go away. It's quite painful and difficult to make an ideology die, actually, to eradicate an ideology. And you can't certainly eradicate a whole religion. But this ideological use of Islam is as dangerous for Muslims as it is for liberals and for anybody else. I mean, this is hideously distorting the Muslim world too, and I think we have to act very seriously to protect liberalism, because the liberalism we have can also be made to go away, mm-hmm. actually, and these freedoms are more contingent. You know, I guess most of us grew up in the post-war era. Certainly I did, the 60s and the 70s and the era of feminism and gay rights and equality, etc., and debate and so on. This hideous, grotesque devotion, this terrible obedience, it's really stubborn. We're really going to have to put ourselves on the line over this. I think it is a real threat all over the world, and I think we really have to consider what our own values are and really consider about how we're going to eradicate this. But it's going to be a long cycle. It's going to take, you know, 25 years to get rid of this, and it's going to cause a lot of let's say discomfort.
Mm-hmm. Do you think the answer is in? I mean, as you said, your family were Reaganites, Thatcherites. Do you feel like you're following in the family footsteps in terms of finding the world leaders who might put an end to this type of threat?
I really think that we have to find a link with Muslim people too, with Muslim people who are Muslim children, young people are profoundly oppressed by this mm-hmm. ideology. So the idea that it's a clash of civilizations is a very naive, simplistic, and probably very stupid idea. It's possible to find real solidarity with people in Pakistan, in Syria, throughout the Third World, who also hate this hideous, very dangerous and vile ideology. So I don't think it's not an East-West thing or a white-black thing. It seems to me that we probably need to think very hard about how we're going to protect our own ideology against this really what is a death cult. But I wouldn't certainly align myself with Reagan or Thatcher. That would be naive too. Mm-hmm.
So Donald Trump and David Cameron are not necessarily the guys with the answers.
I wouldn't say they were, Jonathan, no.
Well, you actually say in The Last Word, and I don't remember exactly how you said it. You said it much better. But at one point when the young biographer is talking about his subject, Mamoun, and he gets away from thinking about all the sexual peccadilloes, he says that the reason that he fell in love with Mamoun's writing was because words mattered. The idea that words mattered, and I think you actually say, in the struggle against religion. Is it up to the writers, therefore, to lead the charge for some type of understanding of the current situation?
I'm a big fan of the word, and I think we need more words. That's why those who write words and those who speak are dangerous. That's why in Pakistan, in South America, and around the world, and China, of course, there are so many writers and artists and journalists in prison. It's a tribute, you might say, to how dangerous words are. And we have to use language to speak out against the horror of Islam, the horror of religion. As far as I'm concerned, there are no harmless religions. You know, I think Islam in itself is a danger, but it's possible to reduce it in some ways, in the way that the force of the Catholic Church has been reduced. I think any devotion, any obedience to a book, to a rule, is a form of profound idiocy. And the idea of kissing God's ass is as horrific to me as the idea of kissing Fidel Castro's ass. I was in Cuba. I was in Cuba 2 days ago for a day. I went to Cuba as a socialist and I left as a Reaganite, I'm afraid. having having grown up in the 1960s with a great poster of Che Guevara on my bedroom wall, I was very disappointed to see that most of the shops in Cuba still have those same posters of Che Guevara on the wall. They haven't been able to grow out of it, and I was very shocked by this fatuous devotion to a dead revolution and to a hopeless dream.
So it's nice to know that the most shocking image we could have now is not Gordon Wanick and Daniel Day-Lewis kissing, but Hanif Qureshi kissing Fidel Castro's ass. That would be a culture shock. But now but speaking about words, we've got a few moments. If you've got some words out there in the audience to any questions for Hanif. We've also, if you want to ask them in Spanish, we have some headphones here. And let me also say that after we finish our presentation, Hanif will be out in the back in the lobby, happy to sign books for any of you who want that. So any questions from the audience? Okay, I think there's a microphone perhaps somewhere.
Okay. Being an admirer of your work, of your short stories, My Beautiful Laundrette and The Buddha of the Suburbs, I wish I could talk about some of your books, but given that the conversation have tended to walk that difficult line of the Islamic threat, of the Muslim threat, I do find a certain inconsistency in your talk, if I may say, because you talk about the Reaganization of your family, the Thatcherization of your family, and yet we don't seem to remember that well that the foolish invasion of Iraq by Ronald Reagan with the complicity of the handsome and attractive Tony Blair and José María Aznar of Spain have really brought this region to a tragic situation. So I would like you to address that point.
Jonathan, would you repeat the question?
I think what... In Spanish? I'll do it. No, I think the question was that we were in your talking about Reaganism and Thatcherism. You haven't mentioned the fact that, in fact, their successors went in and invaded Iraq, and that caused the current Islamic fundamentalism that exists
now. We've been sitting here for hours, and we haven't mentioned Tony Blair.
I know.
It's shocking that the people of South America haven't heard more about Tony Blair.
But I think the idea
is... As if you haven't suffered enough here already.
But I think, if I may be paraphrasing badly, but that is it partially our fault in the West for the current Islamization? Is that correct? Am I... Okay.
It would be wonderful to be able to blame Tony Blair for every bad thing that happened in the world. And I would be happy, very happy, and my dear friend Stephen Frears sitting up there would also be very happy to blame every bad thing that happens in the world on Tony Blair, and probably with good reason. And I think we're all probably aware that the intervention by Blair and Bush was probably not such a good idea as it seemed to them at the time, and that most Western interventions into the Third World probably cause more bad than they do good. But I would also suggest that there are also many other reasons, probably to do with also colonialism and ideological vacuums that also are, and prisons of Egypt, etc., etc. There are many reasons for the terrible state of relations between Islam and the rest of the world, and it seems to me that there isn't, that wouldn't necessarily be a simple explanation, and presumably this is why we need writers, why we need journalists, why we need people to think and talk about this, why we need more words, you might say. We need less, you might say, Fox News, and real, more serious thought and debate about this very complicated stuff, in order that we can then understand what the hell's going on and then begin to think about how we're going to combat it.
I think if you go back and you look at Hanif's book, The Black Album, you'll see many local reasons, since here's a fictional character, but a very real character, a young man in London who isn't thinking in terms of global, for global reasons, but very local reasons why he's attracted to fundamentalism.
I would also say we should remember that people hate freedom. There's nothing they hate more and want less than freedom. People love tyrannies. Almost every country throughout the whole history, every town, every family throughout the whole of the history of the whole of the world has been a tyranny. People love tyrannies. They feel at home in tyrannies. They feel protected in tyrannies. You know, and that's a much more interesting question. And there have been very few occasions of actual equality and democracy and real socialism and all the good things. Actually, most people can't think of anything that they would like less than freedom, and they flee from it as they would from the devil. And I think that's a much more relevant question to ask about what it is we love about tyrannies and why we go into such trouble all the time to create tyrannies in which to live, and why they work so well for so many people. Mm-hmm.
No, I think very well taken. I live in Italy now, and we went through a period of Silvio Berlusconi, who in many ways was a dictator and a tyrant. And I hesitate to say to my Colombian friends, but you go through various periods as well in which there are stronger leaders who some people support because they're frightened of the alternatives. Other questions out there? Do we see anybody?
There's a lady.
Oh, hi there. I just got the microphone.
Great.
Perhaps you don't realize, Jonathan, but when you speak on the microphone, you sound as though you're calling Hanif Qureshi honey. It's a lovely compliment. Oh. Anyway, while not an apologist for any Wahhabi or Salafi thinking, I just wondered, in extolling the values of liberalism, if you think inherent in liberalism is an intolerance, which is to say that liberals believe they have arrived at a level of thinking that other people haven't. And as such, they are intolerant of people who have not arrived at that level of thinking. I'd like to hear your view on that.
I'm a big fan, I'm afraid, I grew up in the 60s, I'm a big fan of skepticism. I'm a big fan of doubt. I'm a big fan of disobedience. And a big fan of argument. And one of the things I used, when I used to go to the mosque and I used to sit there, and the preacher or the movie used to march up and down and speak, I used to sit there and I think, well, after a time, we're going to now have a period of discussion. And those of us who are sitting in the audience will also speak. And there'll be a view from there and a view from there and from over there, and we'll discuss this stuff about the position of women or homosexuals or whatever it might be. And I sat there for days and weeks, and there was never any discussion from the audience. The speakers had no interest in hearing the views of anybody else. So I became more and more aware of the need for interrogation, for questions, for skepticism and doubt, and so on. And it seems to me that there may be many faults with liberalism, but you might say at the moment it's the best thing that we have, because at least it's self-revising. It's not an awful final doctrine like Islam that tells you who you must be, how you must live, who you must obey, what time you must pray, what time you must wash, every fatuous, stupid little rule that we impose on ourselves is infantilizing. And so at least with liberalism, we have some possibility of some mature discourse and the possibility of revising our lives and living in a new way. If you follow a rule, if you're totally obedient, you have no chance ever of being anything like an adult.
Any skeptical viewpoints on that? Any other questions?
The question over there.
Oh, question down here.
Oh, great. Yeah. Thank you. Well, thank you very much. I have a simple question. I apologize my ignorance, but on the catalog, it's your photo with the passport, and aside from the obvious, I wonder why did you choose this? It's obviously an aesthetic and there is a message beyond that, but I want to hear it from you.
The lady sitting over there says in the catalogue, which I haven't looked at, there's a photograph of me lying in bed with my passport. Well, this is a Colombian guy that did this, who's a photographer, a very, very nice man who I had breakfast with today. And he came to my hotel room when I was in Spain, in Segovia, I think. And he came to my room, he said, could I take a picture of you? I said, okay. He said, but I will only take a picture of you in bed. And until that point, I'd had very little contact with anyone Colombian. And being a man who is very flexible and keen to cooperate with Colombians, I got into bed. So I lay in bed, and he took my passport and he put it there, and then he took a photograph. And since then, I've been a friend and a comrade to the people of Colombia ever since.
Other questions?
One more question.
I think we've got time for one more before we finish up. Back there, man in the striped shirt.
Hi, Hanif. This is more a comment, not a question, actually.
Oh, come on, ask a question.
Okay.
Ask a question.
Yeah. Yo. I just want to say that one day I bought your book, Intimacy, and I sat at the top of this mall. It was all alone. And I read it from the cover to the end in just like, I don't know, 3-4 hours. And I felt like calling like 2 ex-girlfriends. Well, they were not ex-girlfriend because they had this marriage or something. And I want to say to them, like, I'm sorry, girls. I didn't mean to hurt you. And it was really touching for me, that book. Okay, thanks.
Thank you. Yeah, somebody said to me the other day, I want to pay you a compliment. I said, what? He said, I read one of your books and then I divorced my wife. I said, until that moment, my life had had no meaning.
Was that ex-wife one?
Now I know why I'm a writer.
And that ex-wife was one of your girlfriends? Is that true? No? Okay. Okay, well, let me thank again the marriage guidance counselor and the wonderful writer, filmmaker, Hanif Qureshi.